Tonight is Leonard H. Stringfield, who is an investigative reporter of the First Order, and he has been dealing a great deal into this matter of crashed UFOs in the United States and the government secrecy surrounding them, and we're trying to figure out why. And we're opening up our lines now to Leonard. We have a number of stories to tell you, but we want to get some of the questions from you. Leonard, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
And young David is with us, who voluntarily called in with us tonight.
Bill?
Yes.
If there's time, I'd like for David to recount just a little briefly his experience in seeing a disabled craft on the ground at Fort Raleigh, Texas. Also of interest, I have a source, a very reliable source, a former CIA employee who backed up that story. He didn't give me any information concerning the incident, but he did back up the incident. And I think that's very important, plus the fact that I have another source who did back up David's story. So if he does have time a little later, he might recount it very briefly.
Well, David, if you want to, why don't you go ahead now?
Okay, Bill.
Okay.
Well, in 1964, I was stationed in the Army in Fort Riley, Kansas, which is located right about in the center of the state.
Mm-hmm.
On the night of December 10th, 1964, or the morning of the 10th, I had a regular guard duty assignment guarding the motor pool in an area of the fort. Fort Riley is broken down into like five sections, Fort Camp Funston, Main Post, Camp Foresight. And anyway, on this particular night, I was guarding a section of the motor pool in Camp Foresight. Guard duty was 2 hours on, 4 hours off. Around 1 a.m. on the morning of the 10th of December, 1964, I was to, you know, be relieved. And a lieutenant came up to me and, you know, brought the Jeep up into the motor pool area, got into the Jeep, and he started driving away from the barracks where the guards slept. And we started going into the back roads of the Fort Riley area. I estimated we drove maybe for about 20, 25 minutes or so, and he told me to get out of the Jeep. I went to this truck, and standing behind the truck were two other enlisted men, specialist fourth class, and another PFC, and also a number of officers. And yeah, I have to backtrack here for a few seconds. On regular guard duty in Fort Riley, Kansas, we were only given 3 rounds of ammunition. That's all, 7.62 NATO round for the M14 that was used at that time. We were given a full clip of ammunition, each one of us, from the back of this truck.
Hmm.
And we were told that a secret aircraft from Offutt Air Force Base, which was located in Nebraska, the next state up, had become disabled. And we were to put a security net around it, and the object was top secret, a classified object. From where this truck was, we hiked up and down about 3 or 4 hills, so that was about another 25 to 45 minutes, I'm estimating. And it was quite dark, and we really didn't know what was happening. I mean, you know, we're half asleep, and all I wanted to do was go back to bed. All of a sudden, we heard like a thrashing sound, like a... Turned out that thrashing sound was a Huey-type helicopter with a very, very tremendous bright beam on it. You know how the police here in the L.A. area look for criminals with a beam?
Sure do.
But it was much, much more intense, maybe 3 or 4 times brighter. Anyway, this chopper would go back and forth over this semi-flat terrain, and all of a sudden it lit up this round, disc-shaped object. And I stood back about that time. I would estimate we were maybe about 100 to 150 feet away. And I said, you know, my God, you know, the thing looks like a flying saucer, jokingly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we got right up to it. We walked around it. That would be about probably around an hour. Now, during this time, during this hour, the Huey helicopter would go back and forth over the field or the terrain area there. The light would constantly be scanning the ground back and forth, would come over the top of the object, 60 to 200 feet above the object, hover over it, light it up, then fly off. This went on approximately the entire hour I was there. The craft, and this is going back quite a few number of years, the craft was about roughly, like a hamburger bun with like the meat sticking out of the middle, but it wasn't a hamburger. It was like little squares that were jutting out from it, kind of the appearance of hard rubber. For lack of a better word, it had a fin or a port on it. Below that was a round type opening, which I'm calling an exhaust port. I really don't know what it was. When you got real close to this thing, by real close I'm saying within 7 inches to maybe 25 or 30 inches, the air was definitely warmer, and you could feel that because it was very, very cold that night. Eventually a 5-ton truck came there, some radio equipment was set up, other men came around there, around the area, and we were told to leave, that we were no longer needed there. This would put the time at around 3 a.m. in the morning. So the original, myself and the original men that were by that deuce and a half truck were marched back to the deuce and a half truck, and we were told never to reveal or repeat what we saw there that night, because that object definitely was a secret object from Offutt Air Force Base. And to this day, going back to what I saw and photos that I have seen since that date leads me to an awful lot of speculation that what I saw that night was not, quote unquote, a secret object.
Hey, David?
Plus, why, if that thing was paid with taxpayers' dollars in 1964, why hasn't it been revealed in 1980 or 1979?
You provoke a lot of questions, and let's get back to those in just a moment, shall we? But we're letting you know about it tonight, or at least giving you some information that seems to be of merit, at least to listen to and weigh. My guest tonight is Leonard H. Stringfield, who is an excellent investigative journalist who has checked around the country on this over and over again. No telling how many hours Leonard has spent on that, talking to people who have been involved in the process that has gone on for many years now of retrieving crashed UFOs and their occupants. And we also have a surprise guest, a young man who did, in fact, guard one of these out in Kansas some time ago. He is on the line. And we're ready now to continue our conversation with Leonard. Leonard, before we get into letting you field some calls from our callers and from the audience out there, is there any other thing that you'd like to mention to? There are a number of stories we can get into, and we will during the course of the evening.
All right. Well, I think, first of all, Bill, and I'm sure that the curiosity has been aroused out there where to get the paper. So
let's do that again. Yes.
That they the title of the paper is the UFO Crash Retrieval Syndrome. That's quite a mouthful. But if you write for the paper, just mention status report number 2. It was published by the Mutual UFO Network, and the initials are MUFON. The address is 103 Old Town Road. That's one word, Old Town Road. That is in Seguin, Texas, S-E-G-U-I-N, Texas, zip code 78155. And again, I'd like to stress that there is no profit on this paper. This is a non-profit research organization. The Mutual UFO Network is an international research organization. They took upon themselves to publish the paper at their expense, and all proceeds have been turned over to research on my end, so I'm not receiving a nickel on it. That's the way it should be, because I'm treating some very sensitive material. It should be made public.
Well, I'm glad you brought that out, Leonard, and I can say that it's a fascinating paper, and that's the reason you're on the air tonight with us here on the Open Mind program. You ready to go to our callers? They can be really, really tough on us. Okay, KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins and Leonard Stringfield.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, this is Mel from the San Fernando Valley, Bill.
Yes, Mel.
And I find your program extremely interesting. I'm a researcher, independent researcher, and a little bit of a scholar. There's a couple of questions that come to my mind I'd like to present to your guest, Leonard and David, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've been extremely interested in this UFO phenomena, which I call it, for about 25 years. A very imaginative young man handed me a book about 25 years ago, just simply called UFOs. And, of course, this book went into many different aspects of phenomena, unexplainable phenomena, and of which UFOs was a part of the book. But what's been bothering me a little bit is that, number one, I was wondering, now, has there been a sequence of crashes like in the last 20 years? And what is the most recent date of a known crash?
Okay. The first known crash, to my knowledge, occurred back in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, there have been about 13 crashes. These are incidents that I have had the opportunity to investigate or talk to people who were aware of these crashes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, they are not, it's sort of a rare thing when you consider the number of UFOs who have been seen, you know, by the thousands over the many years since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking in terms of 12 or 13 crashes. That's not too often.
Mm-hmm.
However, my figure is this may be the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been many, many more.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have occurred overseas. This is not strictly in the United States, and I think that should be emphasized.
Which may be one of the
reasons. The most recent crash, I'm unable to get details at this time, occurred in Australia just a couple months ago.
I see.
Now, I have no details on that one. But, again, there was a crash in, on the Bolivian-Argentine border on the top of a mountain back in May of 1978. There was also an incident that occurred, in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Where, if the story is correct, I had been unable to back this one up with any first-hand informants. This occurred in an area called, it's a rural region called Lumberton, where allegedly a craft had been disabled, and a military team had been dispatched to the area. And as my understanding, there was quite a melee or some disorder that occurred there that resulted in some casualties on our side as well as the other.
Mm-hmm.
But information is in Pennsylvania, and the investigator or two investigators who were involved in trying to elicit more information were unable. They ran into a very hard door. The man with the information, the first-hand informant, just wouldn't come forward and discuss the matter any further. So I have been unable to penetrate that one.
I see.
And I can understand why that one would be hushed,
mm-hmm.
because if there were casualties involved.
Leonard, are you saying the casualties were brought on by some sort of confrontation between...
Yes, there was apparently a confrontation of a kind. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been unable to get any additional details. According to my very reliable investigator, my informant, why I have every reason to believe these people. But I understand that the first-hand informant has become very elusive and just won't talk.
I think it might be well, Leonard, to point out, too, that not only have there been crashes, but you have in your latest paper an incident that happened at Nellis Air Force Base where there was just an out-and-out landing.
Yes. Well, now, there have been a number of landings on Air Force bases. There was one on Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. I understand there was a landing at Edwards Air Force Base many years ago. I have numerous reports of landings on sensitive installations, including air bases. One on White Sands.
Can I interject here for 1 second?
And some of these, some of the information I received from some very, very good informants, they're a little sensitive about the material, and in some instances, I'm unable to relay anything based on the informant's request. And this, of course, is understandable.
Yes.
But I keep working at it. And those who have surfaced to relate information to me, why I feel very privileged with this information. In fact, I feel freakish with it.
Yes.
At times, because what can I really do with it? And the bad thing about it, Bill, is that it is, to an extent, hearsay that I can't, in most instances, name or identify my source. Because of the sensitivity, these people have been under oath, and they do desire privacy. And you can imagine what would happen to them if their names were suddenly revealed to the media. They would lose all sense of privacy and also be, you know, subject to punitive measures. So in no way will I transgress these people who have given me very valuable information.
Yeah. Of course not.
And that's unfortunate because it'd be beautiful if I could come up with a whole fistful of affidavits.
Yeah, right.
But unfortunately, that time is not now, and hopefully in the future it may be.
Well,
but I'm continually getting new sources. Since the publication of this paper, Bill, I have 7 new informants, mind you,
mm-hmm.
Which could lead to some very, eventually some very valuable information.
Well, if I could just have a couple more seconds. Now, there is one more thing. Am I speaking? This was Leonard. It was just
Leonard Stringfield, yes.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, Leonard. Now, there's something that sort of bothers me, though. Now, evidently, these people, they have to travel over a large distance to reach us. Is this correct now, or is this the assumption that these people are coming from a...
Yes,
from
it, these crashes occur in random areas, often requiring distance for the troops or whatever to get in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now, what concerns me is that if these people, and we have to, I think we almost have to assume that they have... reached a technological level to where they can travel these vast distances. Now, it seems to me that, you know, that by now, if, say, the first few did crash or something happened, they weren't familiar with our particular conditions here on this planet.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that somehow they would have got communication back to their kinsmen or something.
Yes.
You know, and these crashes wouldn't keep occurring. Now, this bothers me. Now, I'm not trying to put any
yes.
any holes in your research. Believe me, because I'm somewhat of a scholar, and I went pretty heavy into math and so forth. But this does bother me. And do you have any kind of an explanation for that?
Is your question now concerning the vast
yes, my question. My question is this: that it seems to me that if they possess the technology to travel these vast distances
yeah.
to reach us here, that they certainly would have navigation equipment that is far superior, probably, to anything that we know right
yeah.
now. And it seems to me that these crashes, certainly could be avoided, especially if their craft is equipped with, some type of gravitation devices or something.
Yes, well, I considered that, too. And I think that anything, life anywhere, whether it's from this galaxy or another galaxy or wherever, and no matter how sophisticated it may be,
mm-hmm.
Everything is subject to error.
This
to,
is true.
To making a mistake. And I think that I think that would include any extraterrestrial.
Mm-hmm.
They're all subject to making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And if the machine is cybernetically controlled,
yes.
Computers are subject to making errors. I know as ours do.
Yes.
And
true.
I have every reason to believe that anyone out there would be subject to mistakes. They may make less of them.
Mel, I think we can get
I would like to add this. Now, since World War II, that's been many, many years have passed, and if we only have perhaps 12 to perhaps two dozen crashes in all those years
mm-hmm.
with these
mm-hmm.
numerous flights that have
yes.
been reported.
Yeah.
But that's actually a small number.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of crashes are seemingly small
mm-hmm.
or rare considering the overall surveillance.
Mr. Greenfield?
Yes.
Yes.
This is David on the line
here. Yes. Maybe as opposed to human air, maybe we can coin a new term and call that humanoid air.
Yes.
Well, by the way, if I may there, gentlemen, if I can jump in there for Mel and the rest of them, I think we have Wendell Stevens on the line. Wendell, you there? Hello, Wendell.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Bill?
Mel was wondering why the crashes are there. These are very advanced in their technology. What's going wrong? And it seems like
yes.
we have discussed that before, that maybe radar or something was one of the
problems. Well, there's another thought here, too. Yes, I've heard that radar, electrical storms, atmospheric conditions, computer error. But there's one other thought. This information has been coming to me here from various sources. And, again, it's hypothetical. But magnetic grid network encompassing the Earth's sphere, and this may account for the UFO's flight pattern, east to west, north to south, and so forth, and in some rare instances cause abortive behavior or the crashes. Now, this is a magnetic grid system which is, encompasses the Earth's sphere. Now, I won't go into that because that requires a lot of technical explanation that's beyond my knowledge, but this seems to account for some of the error in their flight behavior.
Do you have anything to add to that, Wendell, before we go on?
Well, the one case that I was working with over in South Carolina, Bill Herman, I believe you had him on the program one time.
Yes, I did. Try to get him on tonight, but he wasn't answering.
Oh, yeah. Where the alien entities mentioned to him that one of their craft was damaged by a certain kind of radar that was used in... It was nose lock-on radar used on fighter aircraft several years ago that they lost or they had a ship go out of control because they calculated later, because the radar locked on it, and it stayed on long enough to upset the autopilot system or the computer system that ran the craft. And that caused them some problems.
So there's always error there, Mel. It can happen to everybody, and including our friends from space.
Okay.
All right, Mel. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
You're on the Open Mind program. I'm Bill Jenkins. Our subject tonight is crashed UFOs in the United States and the retrieval process that goes on. My guest, foremost investigators of the UFO phenomena, and we have a young man also on the line who has decided to stay with us, and we're glad he has, who was involved in guarding one of these crashed UFOs, an eyewitness to the incident. So let's get on back to it and to our callers. KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins in the Open Mind program.
Hello, this is Louie.
Hello, Louie.
I was just wondering, your description a few minutes ago of what you saw kind of meshes with something that I saw on a very special maneuver that was conducted at Camp Ripley, Minnesota in 64, about June. I was with the National Guard out there in Wichita, Kansas, and I think it was the 32nd Division was what they called it out there. They took us all up to Camp Ripley in a great big convoy. And one moonless night out there, they had us dig in, and we were told to stay in place, that they were going to attempt to attack us. Some special assault groups were. And they were very weird, I thought. They're very unusual, the way they gave us instructions. They told us under no circumstances were we to move. They gave us a lot of instruction in the use of visual purple and night vision training by looking out of the corner of our eyes. And they told us to notify our immediate superior, even if we went to the pit latrine that they had dug out there. And after a few hours of darkness, a little after midnight, I got kind of tired of just sitting in one place. And I went back to the latrine, and then I don't know, I guess I was kind of bored. I took my rifle and I went for about 25 or 30 feet. And I thought I heard something. And so I just stuck down where I was. I didn't want to get in any trouble since they had given us such harsh instructions about moving. My legs had been kind of cramped earlier, and I wanted to stretch out for just a few paces and then go back to my foxhole there. When I ducked down beside these bushes, I noticed a guy was walking very close to me that had a different kind of a uniform than I did. He had a different kind of a helmet. He had something he was holding in his hand that looked like, it was a sighting device of some type where he was able to see through the darkness better than I was. And so I followed this guy for a little while. His weapon looked different than mine. It didn't look like a submachine gun would have looked, and it was smaller. And I thought, this is kind of an unusual guy. If he's the aggressor, there's no use in my just letting him go on, towards our communications gear. So I followed him for a little while, and I think a couple of times he was pretty well on to the fact that I was following him, but being an old country boy, he just didn't quite nail me down. Every time he turned around and looked at me, I managed to duck down and keep myself between the shrubbery and him. But I followed him, I'd say for a good 300 meters, and then I noticed that his footprints, which evidently I could see a little bit in the light. There was no moon, and his footprint just kind of ended at, I would say, a tree that was about 35 feet high. And when his prints ended, I thought, oh no, I really blew it now. This guy's probably sitting right on top of me in the tree. But before I started to look up at the tree, I noticed that the air was warmer. And I noticed there was some kind of a gentle downdraft. And when I started to look up, I noticed something else that startled me almost immediately, where there had been no clouds before, and we at least had the starlight. All of a sudden, I realized that there was no starlight over me. The stars were blocked out by some sort of a rather large object. And so I moved my eyes around rather quickly, to see if I could frame this thing. It was obviously a black object. And when I checked around the top of me, I noticed that it was circular. And doggone if I didn't hear a metal door slide away. And I looked up. There was a square door in the center of this thing, and I could hear sort of an electronic whining sound, one like you'd hear with possibly with hydraulic equipment running, but I'm only guessing.
Lou, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
This is David. This was in Kansas now?
Well,
in Wichita. Can you remember the year?
I was in that National Guard unit
out
year? There that they have on, it's the one south of town there. We were in the old 32nd Division, and they moved us in a big convoy.
What town was it in, or what area, what state?
Well, they moved us up to Camp Ripley, Minnesota for this maneuver.
So this happened in Minnesota?
Yeah, this happened on a moonless night there after they had given us a bunch of training in night vision.
What year?
It was 64, I believe, June, or I believe it was about June of 64. And this object that I looked up and saw bore a very strong resemblance to the one that he said he was guarding, and that's why it kind of shocked me when I sat here and was listening to what he said. Also, the way that I noticed the warm air near it, and when I was under it, sort of a downward, very, very gentle, warm air current. The only thing is that I don't know whether he was under it or not. I would say that I probably saw the same vehicle, but I was under it, and it was painted black, or was black. And but the thing about it was is this square door under on the bottom side of it slid away, and then I could hear the sort of an electronic equipment sound whine. There was no motor noise at any time.
Did you see it fly away, or was that just it? It was above you.
Well, no, I fell backwards then. I was so startled by the whole thing, I fell backwards on the ground, and I was laying there with my rifle looking up at this thing. And the square door, they had red blackout lights in it. I could hear a couple of voices talking, but I couldn't really make out that much what they were saying. I would estimate that they were somewhere around, probably 38 feet or 40 feet above me. And it was a big object. I mean, it was not
What size was this being that you saw?
This
is Len Stringfield.
The man appeared to me to be a soldier with special equipment, the likes of which I'd never seen before. The only thing is that years later, I saw a Mechanics Illustrated story on the Servo Soldier and also the old style radio helmet, the one that was shaped differently with the antenna in the top, and when I saw those pictures of some of their experimental gear that they had in that regard, and the later on when they made it plain that they had the night vision scope, it was obvious to me then that this is what the guy was carrying. But now, let me tell you what happened. I really felt like at this point I was in over my head, and I'd already violated orders by walking away from where they had me stationed. So I got the hell out of there and got back to where I was supposed to be, but the next morning, they had my whole unit up. They had us standing at attention in the sun for somewhere a little over 3 hours. They were screaming at us, wanting to know who it was that left their post, who it was that had followed this guy. They reminded us that there was classified operations taking place. We were told not to leave our post, and I don't know, the way they handled it, the way they asked their questions, it was so frightening that for 4 years I wouldn't even talk to my best buddies in the National Guard unit. I wouldn't even admit that I had done it. But they narrowed it down to where they were sure that it was one of three of us that had followed this guy. He just looked like an average height being to me. I'm 6 foot. He seemed a little smaller, but he didn't seem small enough for me to notice. I was certain beyond a shadow of a doubt later on I was looking for ways to explain it. You know, I guess everyone tries to justify what they see. Later on, I read an article about some of their secret work in quiet copters that there had been a little bit of talk about, and I thought, well, if it was a quiet copter, I could understand it, but there just wasn't any engine noise other than just a faint whine of maybe hydraulic or satellite generating gear.
I'll interrupt you just a second here. I know you don't have the time to go into a full explanation, and nor would I have time to ask a lot of questions now, but would it be possible that you could send me a report on this to my home address and your phone number, and I could be in touch with you?
I tell you, well, we have all of the information on Louis here for you, okay?
Okay.
Leonard, and I'll send it on to you.
All right. I would like to be able to be in touch with this gentleman and discuss it further. I have some questions which I wouldn't want to put over the air.
But anyway, I wanted to say one thing to you before we cut it off. It's been my firm opinion since this incident happened that, and since I saw the later on articles about this experimental military gear that was not adopted in the way of the helmet and all, and which is actually what I saw that night, this guy wearing, I have felt like that this was in the inventory, and I had felt like it was on the order of a quiet copter. But there's other things about it that just didn't quite add up. It's been a long time ago. I don't remember all the details now, I'm sure, as well as I did then. But let me tell you, the last remark that was made to me by somebody who was identified as a United States Army intelligence officer, when they had me in for...